You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Chloe Potter, and Ty Genwright.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, setting the day's agenda with Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, what are we talking about today?
So today we're going to talk about the head of Britain's security service, MI5, has given his first public speech. China is doing something of a clampdown in some of its western regions, and the UK and Iran have swapped a non-resident chargé d'affaires. And we'll talk about what this means.
And as the Serbian government gears up to announce some brutal austerity cuts, we speak to Guy Delorne in Belgrade.
Plus, icons like Nelson Mandela naturally inspire many artists, but now there's a whole exhibition dedicated to his image. We pay it a visit.
He just had an ability to connect with people, not with words so much, but just with the presence and the power of his personality.
And we meet the cream of the crop of British design and manufacture brands.
Can we be happier with the same thing for longer? That's more of a barrier to reintroducing British manufacturing than any kind of financial implications. It's changing the hearts of the consumer to value things for longer.
All that, plus we check in with our man in Auckland and take a leaf around the British papers. All to come here in the next hour on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
President Obama is refusing to back down in the dispute over the US budget, warning he will only negotiate with Republicans if they agree to raise the limits on borrowing. Without agreement, the government could run out of money next week. Mr. Obama accuses Republicans of acting like hostage takers. In turn, they say he's demanding their surrender before any talks. The Democrat leader in the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, claims opponents don't want to end the crisis.
What we're going to do is cut our investments in education, investments in making the future better. We're going to make seniors suffer more while we do not touch revenue. And we will not allow any discussion of closing special interest loopholes. That's how they want us to go to the table. You must be kidding. As I said, who writes this stuff?
The U.S. Federal Reserve could have its first ever female head. President Obama is nominating the current vice chair, Janet Yellen, to take over from Ben Bernanke in January. She's not expected to instigate significant changes in U.S. economic policy. A fire at a clothing factory in Bangladesh has killed at least 9 people. It's 6 months since a factory collapsed near the capital, Dhaka, killing more than 1,100 people. Around 50 have been injured in the fire, which is also near the capital. The Libyan National Coalition is demanding the return of Abu Anas al-Libi, the alleged al-Qaeda leader seized in a raid in the country. It's described the operation by U.S. special forces as a flagrant violation of Libyan sovereignty. But the U.S. continues to defend its actions, and President Obama says he won't allow extremists to dominate the region.
Africa is one of the places where, because in some cases the lack of capacity on the part of the governments, in some cases because it is easier for folks to hide out in vast terrains that are sparsely populated, that you're seeing some of these groups gather. And we're going to have to continue to go after them.
There have been more clashes in Egypt between security forces and supporters of the country's ousted president. Demonstrators gathered at Cairo's university days after almost 60 people died in violence in the city. The head of Egypt's army, who moved against Mohamed Morsi, has refused to rule out standing for president himself. Dr. John Chalcraft is an expert on Egypt at the London School of Economics.
Several towns have been locked down. There have been mass arrests. The top two tiers of the leadership of a very old organization have been arrested. 3,000 supporters have been arrested. There are trumped-up charges, there are seizure of assets. This is a major assault on a significant element in the Egyptian population.
People in Azerbaijan are voting for a new president, though they're almost certain to choose the old one again. There is no serious rival to Ilham Aliyev, who has cracked down on dissent since taking office. He hasn't bothered to stage any kind of election campaign ahead of the vote, but human rights groups accuse him of moving to silence his critics instead. For a sixth day, there have been blackouts in the southern Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. Talks between authorities and striking power workers broke up without agreement. Power cuts have affected railways and airports, water supplies and mobile phones. It's part of a protest against plans to create a new state, Telangana, carved out of the old one. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much. It's approaching 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monaco, Varasiti Cheche.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
De Long, De Long.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London.
Time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us in the studio, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Thanks very much for coming in to us, Raffaello.
Thank you.
And you were at a seminal speech last night, the head of the Secret Service, speaking in public.
Yeah, this is, so I work at a think tank called RUSI, and we do a certain amount of work with government, in particular security agencies. And the head of MI5 came and gave his first sort of public speech. This is the new head of MI5. He's just been in post since, I think, about April. And he came to give his first public speech in which he sort of laid out a number of very interesting themes. He seemed to focus very much on the threat that his service is sort of concerned about. But then he also dipped into this whole debate about, you know, about Edward Snowden, to sort of use a very quick term, which we'd all understand, and what this means for his service and what they're trying to do and how they're able to conduct business or not. And it was a very interesting speech, and I think he sort of laid out a bunch of markers. I mean, a lot of colleagues sort of flagged up the fact that he seems to be stepping into a political debate. You know, in this country, the securocrats, especially people like him, are very much kept out of that. You know, there's a sort of very sharp division between the politics of these things, which we can see in people like Chris Hune giving his mouthing off in his op-ed about not being told about sort of some GCHQ programs, and people who actually do the implementers, who just sort of, you know, stay behind the scenes and sort of pull the strings, if you will. So it was a very interesting speech in both of these perspectives. As I say, on the threat side, he continued to say that he sees a very active and live threat, and he sort of spoke about how the threat was diversifying rather than diminishing. And its sort of complexity is shifting, and sort of geographical spread is.
And as you say, Raffaello, unusual step for him to comment, make an opinion really on that whole intelligence gathering debate, intrusion versus privacy, concerns about that, all stirred up, as you say, by Edward Snowden. He sort of was at pains to reassure people that they're not looking at everyone's emails, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, this is their constant reply. And I mean, one suspects it's probably true. I mean, if you think about the volume of emails that I personally send out every day, and I think I'm probably no exception, I think other people send a lot more. And then you multiply that out by the amount of people you got in the country, you're talking an awful lot of information. And the security service only has, I think, somewhere in the region of 3,000 or 4,000 people. You know, even if these guys are sitting there every day reading every single email, it's physically impossible to do. But there is this whole question, and I think he recognized, and I think he was at pains to say this, is we recognize that people are worried that all of this information is being collected somewhere. And there's a perception that, well, maybe the government could use this somehow retrospectively. And he was saying, no, we only really focus on people who are of interest. We've only got limited capacity, and we've got no interest in wasting our time looking at, you know, your grocery lists or something.
Yeah, but as well, talking about not looking at everyone, and just reading this particular quote from a speech, I mean, this is something that I nearly think should have remained a secret. He kind of talked about, being on our radar as a terror suspect does not necessarily mean being under our microscope. He says the reality of intelligence work in practice is that we only focus on the most intense, intrusive attention on a small number of cases at any one time. It's not a secret he shouldn't really let out of the bag.
Well, I mean, I think it's a reality. And I think if you look at, for example, the incident in Woolwich earlier this year with those two chaps who attacked that soldier in the middle of the street, those are both people who were known to the services and they'd looked at them a number of times in the past, but they hadn't sort of crossed the threshold of concern that meant that we're going to really focus attention on this. Someone once told me that, you know, if you're going to put 24-hour surveillance on an individual, right, you're going to have the security service following somebody around, that requires 30 people per day. You know, so that's so you do the math. If you think of some of the bigger investigations that we've seen in this world, for example, in 2006, there was a very big plot to bring down eight planes on transatlantic routes. You know, the sort of people arrested around the plot was, I think, at least 15 or 20 over a space of a few months. I mean, that's an awful lot of stuff.
Raffaello, moving on to your next story. Aggressive tactics by the Chinese against Tibetans is nothing new, but it does seem that those are intensifying to some degree.
Well, yes. I mean, here we're looking at a state which has a very different approach to the balance that I was talking about before. I mean, when China looks at its Western regions, we've, you know, when we're talking about Xinjiang and Tibet, it's two sort of big provinces that border, that are off to the west. You know, we've often talked a lot about Xinjiang, and we've seen in Xinjiang in particular, there's been a whole spate of arrests recently for people stirring up trouble. But we actually hear less of it out of Tibet for many different reasons. I think there's a perception that Tibetans in general have a different, you know, because of the Dalai Lama's role and his advocacy of peace regularly, there is a tendency for there to be less violence emanating from the state. And so it's actually quite surprising that we see these sorts of incidents. But what's happened here is apparently in a province called Biru, there was a protest there, and this protest came about after there was some arrests of some individuals locally, and the police decided to disperse this by shooting into a crowd. It's unclear how many people have died. Apparently about 60 people have been injured. An unknown amount have been arrested at the same time. It's, you know, it's very difficult to know exactly what's happened in this story because the government has a very tight lid on information out there.
And did we know that the plight of the Tibetans and the separatists there is... well, I mean, we know clampdowns are common, but this type of opening fire on a crowd is not particularly common. I mean, do you think this is just a one-off by a rogue policeman, or is this signal maybe a change in tactics?
I think that, you know, Tibet is a fascinating one because Xinjiang, there's always a perception that very hard line is required and it's a hard line that's enforced. And, you know, there seems to be exceptions. That's what you have to do. Tibet's interesting because Tibet has a very different place in the sort of Chinese outlook, if you will. It's much closer to this sort of sense of nationhood and everything else. Xinjiang is still part of the country, but it's more detached in a way because, you know, the communities you're talking about there are ethnically so different. Tibetans are fundamentally closer. And so there's a perception that this is one which is much more close. So the government does have a different sort of approach there. It's been much more about trying to influence populations. And they have these sort of massive information campaigns and people, you know, people being sent to various provinces to try to influence opinion.
Why is that? Why are the Tibetans more important than the Taiwanese, perhaps?
Well, no, I mean, Taiwan is certainly important as well, but I think the relationship there is very different. I mean, sure. At the end of the day, the sort of the PLA and the PAP can't actually send their forces over there without, you know, declaring the international conflict. You know, Tibet is still sort of within their remit of direct control. So I think it does have that difference. And then, you know, the whole Buddhist history and culture, you know, while China is a communist secular state, you know, the leadership probably, if they do have religious leanings, it's more in that direction than anywhere else. And then also the whole struggle with the Dalai Lama is this very important international figure who's got a very high standing. It means that the struggle there is always a far more complicated one. You know, and a sort of brutal hardline approach is really going to just make things worse.
And Raffaella, your final story, another sign that relations between Iran and the West are softening.
Yes, well, here we're talking, you know, the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, yesterday announced in Parliament that Iran and him are going to swap what they're calling chargé d'affaires to work with the country. But it's not entirely clear what this actually means.
They're
to
like
be
half ambassadors, aren't they?
They're kind of half ambassadors, but they say they're non-resident ones.
Right.
So it's unclear why you would have non-resident chargé d'affaires.
But it's a reopening of a diplomatic channel that was closed not that long ago, back in 2011.
Well, I mean, the particular UK embassy in Tehran was closed after in 2011. It was stormed by, or it was came under attack by protesters there, and the ambassador, I think, was attacked in the street a couple of times. And the UK pulled its staff out and shut down the embassy here. So this is good. It's more of an opening. And, you know, we've seen Rouhani's arrival has seemingly, we've seen a number of indicators like this that all seem to be positive and going in a good direction.
There's a lot of suspicion, though, isn't there, that this new Iranian softer regime is really just a ruse. But I mean, just listening to William Hague, the British Foreign Secretary's words here in this piece in the Financial Times, he says it's clear that the new president and ministers in Iran are presenting themselves and their country in a much more positive way than in the recent past. I mean, is there something to be read in there about presenting themselves?
Well, I think, you know, there was a perception that maybe Ahmadinejad, the old leader, was, I mean, he was very loud and very, his rhetoric was quite angry, but there was always a question of how much power he actually had.
His bark was worse than his bite.
Well, exactly. And so here, this new lot are definitely coming in with a very different approach. The dilemma is, does this mean that behind the scenes they're also doing something about it?
Raffaello Panducci, unfortunately that's all we've got time for. From the Royal United Services Institute here in London, thanks for joining us as always.
Thank you.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Côte d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set, this means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's sporting report and over 350 more films on monocle.com.
Now, it's a phrase that people across Europe have come to dread, austerity measures. And the latest country on the receiving end is Serbia. It's announced that from next year, public sector workers will lose as much of a quarter of their salaries. With 25% unemployed already, yet more jobs will be at risk as getting on for 200 state-owned companies will be put up for sale. And 500,000 people are expected to be directly affected by the cuts.
The public face of the plan is an extremely young one. At 29, Lazar Krstic has become Serbia's new finance minister, fresh from a spell as a McKinsey consultant. Before that, he was at Yale University. He's not a member of any of Serbia's political parties. His brief is to bring an outsider's perspective to the table. So, what has he got to say for himself? Well, our correspondent in Belgrade, Guy Delaney, has met Mr. Krstic, and he joins us on the line now. Thanks for joining us, Guy.
A pleasure.
So why is Mr. Krstic picking on the public sector in particular?
Well, it's a very big chunk of Serbia's economy and Serbia's way of life. This country really does still carry much of the baggage, if you want to put it in those unflattering terms, from the former Yugoslavia. And of course, Yugoslavia was a socialist slash communist state, depending on who you talk to, where virtually everybody was employed by the state. And over the past 20 years, there haven't been that many opportunities for reform because we had the long conflict during the 1990s, embargoes, hyperinflation. And as a result, many of the state-owned enterprises have neither been sold off or nor have they been particularly looked after, but they're still responsible for these hundreds of thousands of employees. And Lazar Krstic told me that's a burden that Serbia can no longer afford to carry.
Together with them, state-owned enterprises, we have the public sector more broadly. Public sector here accounts for about 60% of the economy. It employs north of 500,000 people, 550,000 people. My biggest issue with it, obviously outside of the fact that it's a third of the wage bill, is a third of the budget, the way it's structured and the way it's set up, I feel that in the ministry itself, that we need better incentivization, we need performance management, we need an ability to promote people and to also fire people when we need to do that.
Guy, never mind the finance. Is there some degree of social engineering going on here?
I think there absolutely is a degree of social engineering going on here. When you talk to people who live in Belgrade and other parts of Serbia, and specifically about the things which don't quite work here as they really should do, they often say, well, it's because everybody was used to the state or the local authorities. Basically, they were used to other people looking after them. And that doesn't happen anymore, despite the fact that there hasn't really been a full transition to a market economy and democracy as other countries might be used to. And now, well, you'd expect a consultant to come up with some sort of grand solution. And Mr. Krstic is making it clear the government's aiming to make a clean break with the vision of the past once and for all. And according to him, that's something Serbia should have done a long time ago.
The focus now is not only for the administration, but also for the public on ending subsidies and shifting the responsibility for one's well-being or one's standing in society from the state to the individual. We should have done all of these things in 2000, 2003, 2005, 2010 even, 2008 more than any other year, if you ask me, but when everybody else has kind of gone through the same thing in Europe.
Guy, what's the imperative behind this? I mean, is the money running out, or has this got something to do with Serbia's application to join the European Union?
Yes, I think it's got everything to do with Serbia's application to join the European Union. It wants to look good, basically. You can imagine in the present climate in particular, a lot of European Union members are not going to welcome in a country which doesn't look fit to join. They've seen what's happened to Slovenia, just a couple of countries north of here. They've seen what's happened to Greece, just a little bit south of here. And they don't want to welcome in another member who is going to drag down the European Union financially. So Serbia is trying to present itself in a different way. It's interesting when you look at the sort of financial analysts talking about this. There was one from the Royal Bank of Scotland, which admittedly has had problems of its own, of course, but they were saying that the government really has been talking up the problems in Serbia, not talking them down as governments often do, but actually exaggerating them in order to push through these measures of austerity and particularly cutting back on the public sector. And I think that's really is part of this PR effort, if you like, to present Serbia as fit for European Union membership, although that's going to be at least 7 years away.
And we have one more clip to hear from the interview, Guy.
We're doing an event in London. We plan to do more of those. I think it's going to be very important for us to get the message across that things have changed. And what we plan to, we realize that we need to do something, and what we plan to do is going to be really done. And there will be a continuity of policy over the next 3 to 5 years around these topics that we've been talking about, understanding that some of the measures that we will be taking are not necessarily going to be the easiest ones to do, especially in the short term.
This is all, Guy, as well, about selling Serbia as a place to do business as well, because I suppose, interestingly, if it does succeed in winning EU membership, it's going to be unique in Europe as having both free trade with the rest of the EU, but also free trade with Russia. Is it kind of hoping to be a kind of a hub, a kind of a European-Russian hub?
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely what Serbia is playing on at the moment. I mean, it's saying we've got these cultural ties with Russia, both Slavic countries, both Orthodox religion. But, you know, key to all of this is that they do have this free trade agreement in place. So that's what they're trying to do. They've managed to pull in companies like Fiat, Mercedes-Benz are going to be involved in a bus manufacturing joint venture here. Continental, another big German company, has come in. And all of this, they're saying, look, if you come to Serbia, you can export to everywhere. You can produce things at low cost because the wages are very low, and after these austerity measures, they're going to be even lower. And you can export tariff-free to the EU, to Russia, and to Turkey as well. How long this will continue when Serbia is an EU member is another matter, but in the sort of medium term, they're certainly playing up on this as a way of trying to transform their economy.
And Guy, how is all of this being received by the voters there?
Well, you know, nobody's going to be delighted if you suddenly say we're going to take away a quarter of your wages, and at the same time things like sales tax are going to go up. It's difficult enough here already when you consider that the average wage is about 400 euros a month for those who are in employment, and about 25% of the population can't get a job at the moment. However, I think a lot of people do recognise that something has to be done. The country's economy is in a bad state. We've had a democracy now for more than a decade in Serbia, and I think there's a feeling that successive governments have dallied when they needed to take action. And, well, we'll see what the results of these measures are, but I think people may be prepared to give them a go just because they're aware that something has to change.
Thanks so much, as always, for your analysis, Guy. Guy Delaunay, our Belgrade correspondent on Serbia's impending austerity cuts.
Now, how would you like to see a portrait of Nelson Mandela by the British artist Richard Stone, a portrayal of him playing the role of Jesus at the Last Supper? Or maybe a cartoon showing Madiba travelling through the streets of London with the Queen while a policeman complains that tourists keep asking, who's that little old lady with Mandela?
Those are just some of the examples of the art shown at London's We Love Mandela exhibition, a visual tribute to the peace icon by some 22 artists, all South African, with the exception of Stone. The exhibition will travel around Europe and the United States, but it's launching in London, and it's no coincidence. Monocle's Guy Lutz went along to meet the curator of We Love Mandela, Natalie Knight.
This is the biggest show since I've been working with Mandela Images, and there are 21 artists, plus we were very fortunate to have the extra bonus of Richard Stone, a wonderful UK portrait artist, and his work of Mandela is, he feels, is one of his best works, and I think it's an absolutely wonderful portrait.
And there's a sort of significance of it being launched in London, right, because of all the support the British gave to the anti-apartheid movements.
Yes, the British, particularly in London, because this was really a place where they supported Mandela. And there's a work on the show, one of the memorabilia from the Herald, the front page, that Mandela is free. So it was a subject very close to the hearts of the Londoners. They helped Mandela in his struggle, and they welcomed him, and they celebrated with him, particularly on his 90th birthday. So it seemed like a fitting place to do it in London.
Friends, 20 years ago, London hosted a historic concert which called for our freedom. Your voices carried across the water to inspire us in our prison cells, far away.
I ran the Natalie Knight Gallery in Hyde Park for a long time, 20 years. So Mandela was just, you know, wasn't particularly a subject that I was working on at that stage, but Mandela walked into my gallery in 1993, and it was such a wonderful experience. You can't help but feeling a connection, because there is something very, very strong about this man.
Presence,
he wasn't yet the president, but he has a presence. But more than the presence, he has a humanity. You feel that he's connecting with you. And he shook hands with me in front of a historic artwork of Nelson Mandela, and he shook hands with everybody. He was friendly. The members of my staff all came up to see him, and he was talking to them, and his bodyguards were getting very nervous, but he just pushed them aside. That was something that you can't actually explain. He just had an ability to connect with people, not with words so much, but just with the presence and the power of his personality. Unfortunately, the viewers can't see it, but I'll try and describe for you this wonderful work by Valapi Mazimba. He has created a work by taking an old door, a wooden door, with he's still left the old rusty hinges, and the bolt has been opened, and he's got a portrait of Mandela in profile, looking out, and he's called it Looking Forward. And on the bottom of the door, he's written the word 27, which represents the 27 years that Mandela was in prison. But the look in his eyes actually encapsulate the moment at Mandela, described in his book, The Long Walk to Freedom. He said, as he walked out of prison, he realized that if he didn't leave behind his bitterness and his hatred, he would be a prisoner forever. And that is what actually was so amazing, that a man could do that he could learn to forgive and to reconcile with people who had imprisoned him for all these years.
What strikes me is that despite the terrible connotations of the apartheid, Most of these works express hope.
There were words by Mandela which he said that it was actually only hope which kept him alive in prison and enabled him to go through those 27 terrible years, because he always believed that he would be able to come out and achieve great things. I don't know if even he thought he would be able to achieve what he did, because to come out and to reconcile a country which was really on the brink of revolution, it was just an amazing achievement. And some of this achievement is mirrored in the work by the British artist Richard Stone, who's captured in his eyes a tremendous amount of sadness, but also there's a quiet dignity and there's a feeling of achievement in the work. Never a trace of arrogance, but just the fact that he's saying he feels satisfied that he has achieved something.
It's a sense of overcoming something.
Richard Stone said he went over and he had several sittings with Mandela, 1 hour at a time, and he said he was very quiet and very still, and then after a while he started relaxing, and Mandela was asking Richard Stone about his family, and he saw the man relaxing. He said it was easy to capture the geography of the face. He's a portrait painter, he said, but what he was trying to capture was the spirit behind the man. And I think it's a very, very strong portrait. He really has captured the spirit. And what people have commented about him is, you know, today we all revere the body and the sportsmen, and that those are our heroes. But this is amazing, that we were also able to tap into the hero of the spirit. And that's what Mandela is. To us, he is our hero.
The curator of the We Love Mandela exhibition, Natalie Knight, ending that report there. The exhibition is on now at South Africa House in London until the 16th of October, ahead of its world tour. You're listening to Midori House.
Coming up in the next half hour of the programme, we head to Auckland and find out why New Zealand's population isn't growing as much as it used to. We'll also meet some of the best entrepreneurs from right here in Britain.
Can we be happier with the same thing for longer? That's more of a barrier to reintroducing British manufacturing than any kind of financial implications. It's changing the hearts of the consumer to value things for longer.
First, though, Paul Osborne has the news headlines.
President Obama says he won't back down in the dispute over the US budget, warning he won't negotiate with Republicans until they agree to raise the limits on borrowing. If there's no agreement, the government could run out of money next week. Mr. Obama's accused Republicans of acting like hostage takers. In turn, they've said he's demanding their surrender before any talks. At least 9 people have died after a fire at a clothing factory in Bangladesh. It's 6 months since a factory collapsed near the capital, Dhaka, killing more than 1,100 people. It's thought around 50 people were injured in the fire. The Libyan National Coalition has demanded the return of Abu Anas al-Libi, the alleged al-Qaeda leader who was seized in a raid in the country at the weekend. It's described the operation by US Special Forces as a flagrant violation of Libyan sovereignty. There have been more clashes in Egypt between security forces and supporters of the country's ousted president. Demonstrators gathered at Cairo's university days after almost 60 people died in violence in the city. Meanwhile, the head of Egypt's army, who moved against Mohamed Morsi, has refused to rule out standing for president himself. And blackouts have continued for a 6th day in the southern Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. It's part of a protest against plans to create a new state. Talks between authorities and striking power workers broke up. The power cuts have already had a big impact on railways and airports, as well as affecting water supplies and mobile phones. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thanks very much for that. Now, kicking off the next half hour of Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tig Enright and Chloe Potter. What's coming up, Chloe?
Well, it's 8:32 here in London, 8:32 p.m. in Auckland, and we're off to New Zealand to catch up with our man there, Simon Farrell-Green. Thanks for joining us, Simon.
My pleasure.
Now, we've had some interesting, well, surprising statistics that have emerged after the most recent census there.
Yes, we have. So the census was meant to go ahead in 2011, of course, was cancelled by the Christchurch earthquake. So finally happened earlier this year. And starting to get some statistics out of that, one of the sort of gobsmacking things is that the New Zealand population is currently growing by about half what we thought it was previously. So the population for the last 6 years has been going up on average 31,000 people a year, and it was sort of previously thought to be going up by about 60,000. So really throws everyone's projections and assumptions out. So a bit of scrambling going on there.
Just reading the write-up about that in the New Zealand Herald, and it talks about the kind of the implications of this decline in population growth, talking about having to redraw some electoral constituencies. But it doesn't proffer any suggestions as to why the birth rate or the population growth has slowed down. Have you got any ideas?
I think it's a mix of things. The first thing is we've got an ageing population just like the rest of the Western world. But it's quite interesting, if you go back to the 60s, New Zealand's baby boom carried on for sort of 5 or 10 years after, say, you know, that of Britain or North America. And so I think we're probably starting to see the kind of ageing populations happening here that have probably been happening in other countries for quite some time. The other factor to that is, of course, during that period you had obviously a lot of economic uncertainty and quite high migration to Australia. So I think that's probably had an effect. So I think probably in another 5 or 6 years you might see some clawing back, but there's definitely a trend there.
Simon, your second story, questions about the criminal process in New Zealand.
Yeah, this is beginning to really worry a few New Zealanders. We keep having these miscarriages of justice, and we've just had another case of a man by the name of Mark Lundy, who was convicted in 2002 of murdering his wife and 7-year-old daughter. And after a very, very long legal fight, he's just had his conviction quashed by the Court of Appeal, by the Privy Council in London. And, you know, we're talking sort of that's about the fourth, you know, legal trial he's had. And the evidence just doesn't stack up. It's very clear that the police case against him was reasonably shaky, that there were some assumptions in there that should not have been made, and some evidence that was treated in a way that really wasn't up to scratch. And so we're just sort of beginning to see calls for some kind of judicial review external to the court system, because people are just really losing faith in the ability of the court system to sort of oversee itself.
Well, Simon, what's really astonishing, and I guess this is a hangover of British colonial times, but that this had to go to the Privy Council here in London. And of course, there's all manner of costs associated with that, with having an appeal on the other side of the world.
Huge. And this is one of the last cases to go to the Privy Council. As you say, it's an overhang from the colonial system. We now have a Supreme Court. But because this was tried at a time before the Supreme Court existed, it was allowed to progress to the Privy Council. However, it was, as you know, very expensive. It was done, we have a legal aid system in New Zealand for these sorts of cases, and this case was taken without any legal aid. So all the funds were raised either by his support team or for getting pro bono legal effect. So yeah, extraordinarily expensive, and extraordinary that it had to go all that way for these things to be uncovered.
And finally, Simon, it turns out that having a job in a fast food chain isn't such a dead end option after all.
Yeah, yeah. Would you like fries with that? So McDonald's in New Zealand has hooked up with Massey University here. And store managers in McDonald's stores can now cross-credit the points that they've earned in McDonald's own internal diploma system into a university course, which is some pretty extraordinary news, really.
Extraordinary. Simon Farrell-Green, thank you very much for speaking to us from Auckland today.
You're listening to Midori House. After this, we meet some of the most exciting design and manufacture brands at the Best of Britannia Showcase.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
To report on the world, you need reporters around the world. With Bureau in Hong Kong and Tokyo, New York and Toronto, Zurich and, up next, Istanbul, Monocle 24 has a growing network of editors and correspondents. In Tokyo, Fiona Wilson.
From the Tokyo office, we cover everything from politics and business to architecture and design. We might be reporting on Shinzo Abe's radical economic policies or territorial tensions in the Senkaku Islands, as well as breaking news from around the region.
In Hong Kong, Aisha Spears.
From Monocle's Hong Kong office, we take stock of much of the Asia-Pacific region. We're watching everything from Xi Jinping's changing China to the Southeast Asian economies that are fast becoming hubs for young, creative business.
In New York, Santiago Rodriguez-Tarditi.
From the New York Bureau, we cover the latest in food, travel and hospitality trends while keeping an eye on the business developments and political happenings in the US and the rest of the Americas.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The time has just gone 8:40 here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tige Enright, and Chloe Potter. It's time now to preview our next edition of The Entrepreneurs, our weekly business show. For that, we're staying here in London to visit the Best of Britannia, a showcase of British brands and makers who design and manufacture here in the UK.
Curator Anthony Wallace has spent the last 12 months scouring the UK for companies and brands, old and new, who represent the very best of British design and manufacture. We sent Monocle producer Katie Bilboa along to the event to meet some of them.
The level of knowledge and the intimacy of the relationship that we have with our supplier is off the scale.
Tom Kay is passionate about cold water surfing, and his British-based company Finisterre make products for people who feel the same. We're sitting in a large mossy green tent with some piles of wood and a selection of their woolen pullovers and hats. Until a year or two ago, these were all made from merino wool. But now, Tom's sourced a very similar product much closer to home.
You know, we visit Leslie on a farm 5-6 times a year, and then we're really, really getting into the supply chain. We're seeing the technical nature of the animal husbandry, the shearing, and the ability to have a wool up the road in our products is something I'm really proud of.
Outside the tent, Tom isn't the only person excited about British-made products. From speedboats and classic cars to jewellery and even lampshades, the second Best of Britannia is showcasing around 130 companies spread throughout the Farmolo building in central London. It's a maze of Victorian industrialism, with a stunning central atrium exposing layers of wrought iron beams, warehouse floors and beautiful wood-panelled offices. Over the next 3 days, these brands and manufacturers, normally scattered across the country, will have the chance to meet each other and the public. Curator Anthony Wallace.
We've got double the amount of exhibitors, which means we've used every single floor, every single space. We've allowed ourselves to think about more about art. So we've got an art gallery. The seminar area has become a lot more interesting. I think last year it was a classic example of build it and they will come. And we've learnt a lot from that. And this year we're excited because we're a lot more focused on what we need to do to get the awareness for everybody.
It's been a good year for British manufacturing. According to the Confederation of British Industry, order levels are now at their highest since the start of the financial crisis. Ian Oliver is chief executive of iconic furniture brand G-Plan. He's excited by the new wave of entrepreneurs at this year's event.
The thing I love is coming and seeing, you know, young, bright, innovative people who are also often taking a risk. You know, I've talked to people today who said, you know, they've mortgaged their homes on getting their businesses off the ground because they're so desperate to get their brand working. And I think it's the innovation that I find the most exciting part.
And when you wear them, actually, they're really comfortable because they really sort of...
One such company is Dawson Denim, who launched at Best of Britannia last year. They started by handcrafting neat, stylish workwear aprons from salvaged Japanese denim and returned to the event this year with a brand new range of jeans. Co-founder Kelly Dawson.
We funded the whole project just between the two of us. Every penny that we make goes back into the business so that we can build something else. The approach has been real craftsmanship, so I'm really learning the trade from, you know, taking vintage garments apart and learning how they put them back together and sewing them in that way. And I think that whole kind of concept of being built to last is massively important to us.
Another exhibitor tapping into this concept, a fledgling company, Vickers Bicycles. They handcraft bespoke city bikes, with nearly every component manufactured in the UK. They're not the only two-wheel brand to be found at the event, as founder Ian Covey explains.
Mintel did their study this year and they found that, you know, 50% of British males now cycle regularly. So we're seeing a real boom in it. So I think there's space for everybody. We operate at the luxury end of the market. We make luxury city bikes. And yeah, you know, I think it is very healthy.
So the frames themselves are based on an old 80s Peugeot track bike I used to have.
A short stroll downstairs leads to London-based Kennedy City Bicycles, who are just 4 months old and already citing healthy sales driven solely by word of mouth. They sit at the more affordable end of the market, with each hand-built bike costing £500, delivered straight to the customer. The parts are sourced internationally and then assembled into neat, tastefully coloured bikes by company founder James Kennedy. For him, the event is a great chance to reach out to new customers.
It's not Harrods. They don't wander past, look at your bike, kind of fiddle with a price tag and then move on. They're here to talk and they want to learn about what you do. Why buy something that's made in Britain if you don't want to find out about how it was made and where it was made and why it was made? So it's just really nice meeting people and seeing what they think of the products and having that firsthand.
This provenance that James talks about is integral to many of the brands exhibiting here and to the idea of British craftsmanship itself.
That's a limited edition. I think it's about 260 as well.
Guillaume Firmiger is co-founder of Fan Optics, another new design-savvy company who hand-make bespoke eyewear. They're utilising generations of inherited craftsmanship found at a factory on England's east coast, which they say is the last one left making handmade frames.
The frames are made by one guy, so the frame maker cuts the shape, and then there's one guy who makes all the arms, all the temples, and there's one guy who polishes everything. So that's only ever three hands which actually will construct any of the frames. So it's a very small setup, but each of those three gentlemen have a great skill and they've been doing it for many, many years, so they create a kind of real premium bespoke product.
There's a confidence here in British design, and more significantly, British craftsmanship and the quality it offers. Whereas a decade ago, a factory may have been seen as a problem, here it's an asset. And one man who'd like to see more of this is Mark Shaler, author and eco-consultant. He's giving a talk today about the importance of bringing factories back to British soil. But he says our relationship with consumerism needs to change too.
We need to be happier with the products that we buy. We need to step off this replace, replace, replace cycle. And we need to be able to buy products that last a long time. And they need to be more expensive, obviously, because they're made here. So can we move towards leasing products? Can we move towards different financing of products? Can we be happier with the same thing for longer? That's more of a barrier to reintroducing British manufacturing than any kind of financial implications. It's changing the hearts of the consumer to value things for longer.
As the old adage goes, you buy cheap, you buy twice. And for exhibitors here at Best of Britannia, if you don't want that, you buy British. For Monocle in London, I'm Casey Bilboa.
And for more business reports from around the world, tune into this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, premiering tonight at 1900 hours here in London.
Well, in a moment, we'll be leafing through the British press with our very own Welsh producer, Tom Lewis. But ahead of that, we thought we'd play you a song by another Welsh Tom. This is Sex Bomb by Tom Jones. Sex Bomb by the legendary Tom Jones there.
And from one Welsh sex bomb to another. Baby, everybody, though, in this studio turns me on. We're joined by Tom Lewis. Our very own Tom Lewis, who's going to take us through the British papers from one very sexy topic to maybe some equally sexy topics.
Well, I'm not sure about that, really. I think I need a bit of a lie down after that intro. But yeah, we'll start with some good news for the science world here in the UK.
Oh,
the
from sex to science.
From sex to science, indeed. From Stockholm yesterday, the announcement, obviously, of this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. And Professor Peter Higgs from the University of Edinburgh, who is credited with discovering the Higgs, the God particle, which obviously the CERN Hadron Collider of the last few years has been sort of smashing particles together, trying to find it, which they have finally succeeded. So
we've all been hearing about this for the last, whatever it is, year, 2 years now. I still don't really understand what it's all about.
You're asking the wrong man here. Yeah, to go into the details of it. But I will say it's been effectively a 50-year sort of process for Professor Peter Higgs. It was in 1964, I think, when the idea that this particle might exist came for him. He was walking in the Kengorms, and it came to him. He wrote down the proposal on a single sheet of paper, and then from there on, the journey began, as it were.
And it's terribly sweet, actually. Peter Higgs has disappeared off on holiday to escape the media spotlight. He's clearly not an egoist at all.
The University of Edinburgh has been frantically searching for him and not answering his phone.
The PR team are saying, this is our moment. This is our opportunity. Where are you?
Gone absent without leave. So, but good for him. He'll have plenty of fanfare when he gets back wherever he is.
Far better that he's shy and reclusive, I think.
Absolutely. And I suppose if you're a scientist, you don't necessarily do it for the accolades. It's the discovery and the process.
It's the joy of science.
I suppose, without sounding too cheesy. And yes. As a non-scientist myself. But that's the impression
I get from
the outside. I
don't understand the joy of science, but some of it does, anyway.
How were you at science at school, Ty?
I dropped it halfway through. I said, I don't like science.
So you were never a contender for a Nobel Prize?
No, not quite. Maybe for peace someday. Or for literature. But yeah, I was much more of a language person than science, so I dropped them all for my end of school exams.
Tyke, it's good to have focus and ambition, clear ambition there.
Quite.
And you've
Nobel
got plenty
Peace
of time. Yeah, plenty
absolutely.
Of time.
Clock's not ticking or anything.
No, absolutely not.
Tom, what else have you got for us?
So we're going to a bit more of an intriguing, I suppose, story here in the UK. The leader of the far-right English Defence League, the EDL, sort of surprised everyone yesterday and came out and said he was resigning from his post and leaving the organisation that he'd been a pivotal part of for quite some time. Now, I think this was a surprise because the prominence of the EDL, I mean, across Europe, I think we've seen the rise of far-right parties and the rise of far-right influence. I don't think the EDL really had the political clout that some of the European rivals had, but in terms of its place in the national psyche, it had definitely been growing. The number of protests had been more visible, the police presence when they were around would be more visible. I think maybe the biggest moment for the EDL in recent times was the horrendous murder of drummer Lee Rigby in London over the summer. And they really used that horrendous death to sort of make their point about radical Islam. Many people agree with them. Many people thought it was pretty bad taste. But now Tommy Robinson went on the airwaves yesterday quite extensively. He said that his family had been getting death threats, that actually this campaign now really wasn't achieving what he wanted it to achieve, and that's why he was stepping away.
But he was also saying effectively that the EDL didn't really represent what he personally believed, and he almost, dare I say it, put forward a reasonable argument.
Well, I think also it's interesting that many of the questions when he said, well, do you actually believe the things now that you believed back in the day? Maybe they've shifted. Maybe the nuance has emerged as you've been.
Has he grown up?
And he couldn't really answer it from some of the things I heard. And I think from the take in The Independent, for example, you know, they're a little bit sceptical, perhaps, about kind of whether you can just change your spots overnight. But I think, you know, the quite a powerful phrase he said was, you know, every time some guy lifts up a shirt with a tattoo of a burning mosque or something on his chest, that really isn't me. And that's really not what I represent. Mm. And he said, I want to take my children to school and just not feel threatened anymore. So the interesting twist is that he's going to work with this non-extremist think tank now. And now they are themselves becoming quite being put under the spotlight, if you say, about why they're taking him.
But interesting that that think tank is founded by former people who would say they were once Islamic extremists. So it's like a coming together of former polar opposites.
Yes, it is an interesting affair. And I think actually you'll see members of this foundation come out on the press here in the UK, on the broadcast news, and give statements on various things, whether it's been a terrorist incident or a hate crime or something along those lines. And I think there's always an interesting dynamic here of how you do reconcile someone's past with someone wanting to change their attitudes and actually promote those new attitudes in public.
Absolutely. Tom, you wanted to also talk about a lighter area from the entertainment world, news from the BBC.
Yes.
Pioneering,
so,
as
Auntie,
ever.
As we call her here in the UK. The,
don't want to see her bloomers.
No, absolutely not. Not this time of the day, anyway. The new, well, not so new anymore, but Tony Hall is the head of the BBC, Lord Hall. He gave his first major speech, really, in the role yesterday. He made a big ream of announcements about some of the new projects the BBC would offer, that the BBC would bring to the table. One of those things is a new channel, which means that BBC TV viewers can watch their programmes kind of whenever they want now.
Hardly revolutionary, is it?
No, but I think you always have to look back when it's something the BBC that's funded by the public, that they really, you know, can't sort of go and splash out kind of whenever they want. Mm. Lots of people say that they do, to be fair, but actually, you know, they are often kind of maybe a step behind the curve, but I think their argument would be that they then want to do things properly and do things that really sort of set the standard. And arguably with something like their iPlayer, which allows you to watch again, they have done that and it's been an incredible success for the BBC.
But they're also talking about shaking up the iPlayer and the way it shows content.
They are. So maybe this is the residue of the Netflix scenario, which allows you to watch TV whenever you want. The BBC is now also going to allow you to watch programmes before they've been broadcast on television. That's a little revolution there.
Thank you very much for that whiz around the papers, Monocle's Thomas Lewis there. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Dennis, our researchers, Gaia Lutz and Harriet Thorpe, our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, is The Menu. And stay tuned for the briefing at 12 in London and 7 in New York. Aperitivo will be on at 1800 hours London time, followed by The Globalist Asia at 2000 hours. Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Han will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Chloe Potter.
And from me, Ty Genwright, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.